On this month's cover is an extraordinary guy. He has been described as a cross between Jack Welch and a Buddhist monk, and as the Indiana Jones for the digital age. Tim Ferriss is the author of the 4-Hour book series, the latest of which, The 4-Hour Chef. He is an advisor and faculty member at Singularity University, based at the NASA Ames Research Center, which focuses on leveraging accelerating technologies to address global problems. Tim's work has been featured in The New York Times, Forbes, The Economist, The New Yorker, and, of course, Success. It is our great fortune to have him here with us for this month's audio so we can learn about the world according to Tim Ferriss. Tim, welcome to Success. Great to have you here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So start off by sharing your story with us here. What do you think has made you, Tim Ferriss, super successful and worthy of the cover of Success magazine?
I suppose the worthy will be decided by the readers, whether I am worthy or not. But I can speak to, I think, some of the habits that I've acquired that I think have helped me to get a few things right. And I don't think you have to get everything right. And I think Warren Buffett would say the same thing. If you get a few things right, that can really take care of almost all of your goals. And in my case, I think the first was reading a piece called 1,000 True Fans by Kevin Kelly, who is a co-founding or founding editor of Wired magazine. And 1,000 True Fans is really focused, and it's free. It's available online. It's focused on identifying who your 1,000 ideal customers or users are. And once you figure out who they are, where they live, what they read, what they eat, where they go, what they watch, etc., you can address them very, very effectively in a customized way and in a very cost-effective way. And I did that, for instance, with the 4-Hour Workweek. When I wrote that, I identified that my core audience that I wanted to go after, the first 1,000 people, were tech-savvy 20 to 35-year-old males living in San Francisco and New York City who read tech publications. And that gave me immediate clarity and focus in a way that allowed me to, say, pick events like South by Southwest and so on in Austin, which allowed me to instigate that tipping point. So I'd say that's the very first thing. And when you do that, it also gives you the clarity to say no to 1,000 things. Mm. And whether you're looking at Steve Jobs or Warren Buffett, they all emphasize the importance of saying no to 99 out of 100 things. And you can only do that, though, if you have clarity of purpose, and you get that by deciding on your 1,000 true fans.
So you deem yourself a lifestyle designer, and in that process, you do some pretty wild experiments using other people and often yourself as the guinea pig. Last year, I know that you did a little experiment with Andrew Hallis, which you went around hugging strangers. I mean, honestly, what on earth possessed you to conduct the experiment? And then what, of course, did you discover as a result?
The hugging strangers was a very fun but also nerve-wracking experience. And there's video on YouTube for people who want to see it. But the goal here is really something that I try to keep in mind. There's a quote from, I believe it's Eleanor Roosevelt, which is, do something every day that you're afraid of or that scares you. And the wider you can expand your sphere of comfortable action, the more options you have and the more successful you can be in whatever you choose. So I will routinely schedule things like that that make me uncomfortable. And I think if you can become comfortable with discomfort, it really opens up doors that you couldn't have imagined otherwise. And there are two types of stress. You have eustress, E-U-S-T-R-E-S-S, which is good stress that builds you. And then you have distress, which is perhaps the negative voices in your head that really don't help you with anything in terms of growth, but beat you down. And exposing yourself to, say, a comfort challenge where you go into a coffee shop and, like my friend Noah Kagan recommends, you know, ask for 10% off when they give you the price. Walk into a coffee shop, they give you the price, ask for 10% off. Something as seemingly silly as that, if you dose yourself in small ways continually, you really empower yourself to have difficult conversations, uncomfortable conversations. And I think that your success in life can be measured in your ability to have those uncomfortable conversations. And the hugging was just another way for me to make myself just an eensy teensy bit more uncomfortable so that I could realize the worst case scenario isn't that bad.
Yeah. And I agree with the Eleanor Roosevelt quote of doing something every day that scares you. It's a metric that I use on myself every single day to assess whether I have done something. The hugging is a little bit more intense than what Mark Zuckerberg does, which is to wear a tie all year or even to learn Mandarin. So I appreciate the audacity of it. So most of what you do is test these theories and ideas as part of your life designing process, like this hugging thing we just talked about. Tell us about the most outrageous thing that you have subjected yourself to test a theory.
Oh, there are a lot of those. I would say two that come to mind. The first is outsourcing all of my dating. At one point, I did this because a friend of mine, I was having a dispute with a friend of mine, and he said, look, I know you talk about outsourcing. That's all BS. I don't need to send Excel spreadsheets to India to have someone work on computation for me or my accounting. He's like, what can I use outsourcing for? And I said, you can use outsourcing or delegating for anything. Anything you can do, just about, except for your superpower, your unique skill, you should be delegating or eliminating. And he said, I don't believe it. And I said, well, look, why don't you tell me what you think I can't delegate or outsource? I'll do it. And if I'm able to do it, you have to get me a case of wine. And his mom worked at a winery, so he agreed to it. And he said, dating. I want to see you try to figure out matchmaking. And so what I did is I created a project on Elance at the time. They've been bought by Odesk now. And I set it up like a real business project. And I hired teams in Jamaica, in Manila, Canada, all over the world, who were each assigned a dating site. And each of them had a profile to work with. And they couldn't pretend to be me. That was one of the criteria or the conditions. They had to message people and say, this is Venkatesh writing on behalf of Mr. Tim Ferriss. And I gave them exactly the type of woman I was looking for. And they had 2 days to book coffee dates up and down one main street. And then they would get performance bonuses for the number of dates that they booked. And had somewhere between 20 and 30 coffee dates in less than 48 hours, just going up and down this one main street from coffee shop to coffee shop to coffee shop, and ended up with a long-term girlfriend out of it. And the whole experiment cost me about $300, including all the bonuses and so on. And I looked back on, as I think many men in particular will, and at all of the just thousands of hours of wasted time and money trying to date or meet women or meet a significant other really ineffectively. And so I found it very enlightening and also depressing that it was so easy to go about doing it with outsourcing. And there were some hiccups along the way. I had my outsource teams mix up a couple of names, which created a very awkward situation. I had one team that claimed to be in Montreal apologize for a delay because a bridge had gone down in Manila. And I was like, wait a second. And it turned out they were actually in the Philippines. So there's a little bit of chicanery, but that would be, I think, something that most people would consider absurd, but it still produced fantastic results. So I think there's a lot of value in exploring the absurd.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. Fantastic example. So Tim, if you think back over the past decade or so, since the launch of the 4-Hour Work Week and building your visibility and fame and brand, what do you feel you got, let's say, wrong, or you've changed your position or opinion about since the beginning of this fantastic journey you've been on?
That's a very good question. It's a tough question. I think that in the beginning, and I think this is very common, when the 4-Hour Work Week finally, when it actually hit its inflection point, started taking off, and keep in mind, it was turned down by 26 or 27 publishers. It was this was not a book that anyone really expected to do anything. It was very hard to get published. When it hit its inflection point and then hit the New York Times list and it stayed there for 4+ years unbroken, my initial goal with audience was to have the largest audience possible. Once I figured out the 1,000 true fans and the snowball started to grow, I wanted to have the largest audience possible. And I no longer feel that way. I think that it's not the size of your audience. It's the intimacy and quality of your audience. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very easy to imagine a lot of people in, say, the marketing world think of the size of their list, their email list or whatever it might be, as the main measurement of value. And what I would point out is, you could go to, say, just making this up, but a like junior high school basketball game in some places and have a few thousand people in the audience. And you might have fewer people at a TED event, right? But does that mean that the audience at the basketball game is more valuable than being in front of all of the people who attend TED? And of course, the answer is absolutely not. That's ridiculous. And there are many other examples that you could point to like that. Or, would you rather have the readership of the National Enquirer or the readership of Esquire magazine? Or name your outlet. And so I've become much more precise about exactly who I am writing for or who I am creating podcasts for or TV shows for. I don't think that in this particular case, size matters as much as people think. If you hit the right 100 people, you can change the world.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm curious about your thoughts on your brand. I mentioned to a friend of mine that I was going to be speaking with you today, and he said, "Who's that?" And I said, "Have you ever heard of the 4-Hour Work Week?" And they're, "Oh yeah, the 4-Hour guy." So when you hear your name and people think, "Oh, he's the 4-Hour Work guy," talk about being branded like that. Is it something that you expected or wanted, or is it something that you work at being more than that branding on a daily basis? How has this worked out for you?
The 4-Hour brand is a blessing and a curse. And I have no right to complain, so I won't. It's really done tremendous things for me. But I never expected the 4-Hour Work Week to turn into what it became, which was this blockbuster book. I had no anticipation. I had no desire at the point that I thought of the first book and started conceiving and putting it together to ever write a second book or a third book. And so only when it became this piece of pop culture in a lot of ways. And I remember the day it was parodied on Jay Leno, and it was so surreal to me that it had gotten that well known. I mean, it just seemed like a dream state. And it was also parodied on The Office, and then on and on and on. The reason that I wrote The 4-Hour Body, one of many reasons, is that I wanted to diversify my identity. So what I realized was, and a lot of people paint themselves into a corner by doing more of what works. And that's very often a good philosophy and tactic. But in the case of, say, a writer, I didn't want to be the 4-Hour Work Week guy forever. I didn't want to talk about email autoresponders for the rest of my life. And I didn't want to throw away all the brand equity that I'd built. So I decided to take a complete left turn and write a book about optimizing physical performance, and basically a choose your own adventure book to losing fat, incredible sex, better sleep, and 50 or so of these micro chapters. And my feeling was, and the strategy was, to test this. And if it worked, I would automatically have diversified my identity so that I'm not as pigeonholed. I would have maintained the 4-Hour brand, so it'd still be more valuable. And that would open up many, many options for me. And I wouldn't feel trapped in sort of a stage persona of the business or lifestyle guy. And on the flip side, I very often ask myself, and I know Richard Branson does the same thing, you know, what's the worst that can happen? What is really the worst case scenario? And trying to cap the downside. And the downside is very easy to quantify. If the second book flopped, I could always go back and simply say, you know, I tried to take that left turn, didn't quite work. Now I'm going to write The 4-Hour Work Week Revisited, The 4-Hour Work Week Expanded Edition, The 4-Hour Work Week, The 3-Hour Work Week, The 2-Hour Work Week, whatever the hell I wanted to do related to the business stuff. That option didn't go away just because I explored a new direction.
Speaking of a new direction and a bit of a left turn, your last book was The 4-Hour Chef. So we know you're not necessarily a chef, and it's really not necessarily a cookbook either. Explain the premise of the book and kind of what you were tackling to put that book together and what people might expect if they pick it up and how it's done.
The 4-Hour Chef was perhaps the most unusual book that I've written thus far. And it was part of a master plan of sorts, meaning Ben Franklin, right along with Richard Feynman, is one of my dream attendees. If I could invite three people to dinner, he would be one of them, certainly. Just a fascinating case of entrepreneurship and diplomacy and someone who is a polymath. And he's, of course, known for many things, but including the early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. And the healthy, wealthy, and wise trifecta was something that I had in mind to try to cover with my first three books. So you have wealthy 4-Hour Work Week, healthy 4-Hour Body, and then wise was intended to be my exploration of accelerated learning, which I've done massive tests on for language acquisition, sports acquisition, anything acquisition for decades now. And I studied, you know, neuroscience and then language acquisition at Princeton in my undergrad years, and have spent an incredible amount of time on this, but hadn't written a book about it. So the question was, how do you make learning sexy? Because people think learning, they associate it with perhaps bad experiences at school. And the way you do that is through stories and self-experimentation. So I decided to take a skill that I had tried and failed at many times, and that was learning to cook, and to use the story of me learning to cook with tons of sidebars on, you know, surfing and memory competitions and all sorts of cool stuff for people who don't care about cooking, to use that as a Trojan horse or a vehicle for making people, you know, 10x what they were in terms of learning capacity. I just wanted to create world-class learning machines. And that was the goal of the book. And I think it does it in a very graphic, illustration and photograph-rich way that is very different from the first two books. But the common threads of, like, how do you apply an 80-20 analysis to, say, get to top 5% in the world in a skill within 6 months? How do you do that? You know, how do you break down a skill? And there are very, very concrete ways to go about doing that, and questions you ask yourself. And once again, it comes back to kind of testing assumptions. You know, if somebody says you have to, if you want to learn how to swim, you need to do A, B, C, D, and E in that order, then you ask questions like, well, what if I did them in reverse? What if you had to remove half of those steps? I know it's impossible, so you say, but if you had to, which steps would you remove? And so on and so forth. And it's just a handful of 5 to 10 questions that can really make you very quickly double your learning speed. And it's not everything incredible has to be difficult. I think this is an important thing. That doesn't mean that everything incredible is easy to accomplish, but not everything with that seems incredible has to be difficult.
I like that.
So, Tim, you say it's possible for anyone to become world-class at just about anything in 6 months or less, which, of course, goes against the Malcolm Gladwell of 10,000 hours idea of mastery. And maybe those aren't the same point, and you can explain it to us. But explain how we can all be world-class at the skills that we need or want to learn. What does it take?
So let me provide some context, and then I'll explain what it takes. The first is the 10,000-hour rule is really the 10,000-hour theory, and they're just too many counterexamples for me to accept that as a valid theory for most things. I've spent my entire career seeking out anomalies and exceptions to that. So I've just seen too many exceptions for me to really buy it. Mm-hmm. And there's some great examples. If you want to learn to play the guitar, you know, Google Axis of Awesome. And I think it's called the 3-chord song. And they show how you can learn 3 or 4 chords and play almost every pop song you've ever heard in your life. It's a really hilarious and enlightening demonstration. Or you could look at someone like Barry Ross, who's a coach from Los Angeles, who predictably and repeatedly produces world and national champion track and field athletes. And he does it by training the deadlift. And he makes his athletes incredibly strong. And so there are 120, 130-pound girls, high school girls, who can deadlift 400-plus pounds for repetitions. And one is inclined to say, well, there's no way I could do that. Those are mutants. And I tested it on myself, and I added more than 100 pounds to my deadlift in about 8 weeks. It was completely insane. So the first step, I would say, is just the belief that your job is to not look for the average approach, not to look for the most common approach, but to look for the anomalies. And by anomalies, ideally, you're looking for, and you can do this on Google very easily, is look for controversial trainers. Look for athletes who are good at something who shouldn't be. For instance, Paralympic athletes who have to swim without legs. Fantastic way to study swimming. And in fact, that's one of the things I did when I was looking at total immersion, because whenever I was forced to use kickboards in training, I would get exhausted, I wouldn't move, and I'd get very frustrated and embarrassed, and I'd leave and I'd quit. So I asked myself, you know, what if I had to learn to swim without kicking? And these what-if questions are very powerful, and you can pose these to teachers. So for instance, I'll give people a very quick and dirty way to tackle sports. Let's just say the sport is in the Olympics. Search silver medalist, then the type of sport, or you could search Olympic medalist, the sport, and then your city or a city nearby, and try to find a silver medalist who did not get the limelight exposure that a gold medalist did, so they'll be easier to reach. And try to have a Skype session with them where you ask them about their chosen sport and training and so on. And there are a handful of questions that are really, really powerful. First is, who is really good at this sport who shouldn't be? In other words, they're not built for it. So if they're an ultra endurance runner, I want to find, you know, the really big fat guy who finishes 50 or 100 mile races. Who's that person? And the reason I ask that is because you'll find a skill set and training that this person uses to overcome mediocre genetics. You don't want to just look for the Michael Phelps who have these completely alien-like physiques that you can't replicate. Mm. You need a skill set, a toolkit that you can replicate. And then second, and then I'll let us move on and we can dig if you'd like, is asking them something absurd like, I've never finished a 5K, but I want to run a marathon. If you had to train me for a marathon in 12 weeks and you had $1 million on the line, I know it's impossible, but how would you do it? Mm-hmm. And you get some very interesting responses. The truth comes out when you start to compress timelines like that. So those would be a few approaches. And of course, I go into a lot of depth in the 4-Hour Chef and the TV show, The Tim Ferriss Experiment. If you don't want to read a 600-page book, then 21 minutes per episode will get you a pretty good handful of these tactics and tools too.
Yeah, it's good stuff too. And so that kind of leads me to this question as we sort of stand in the moment of now, look over the horizon. Based on the people you've been interviewing, the connections you have, the people you're hiring, you know, managing your content and so forth, the type of conversations you're having, questions that you're asking, what's next for you? You got a TV show? Is it movies? Like, where are you taking this lifestyle design process forward from here?
I think most of my goals are personal and not business related at this point, and have been for a while. So, I mean, they sound silly because people will be like, well, why don't you just do X, like get a dog? I need to get a dog. I've wanted a dog, grew up with dogs. I've wanted a dog as an adult for decades, but I've been very conflicted because I've never had a dog in a city. I grew up in the countryside and on Long Island. And so there are personal goals like that, but I very rarely, and this is a controversial perspective, but it works for me. I do not have 5 or 10 year professional goals. I have, say, 3 to 6 month experiments. So I had this TV show just came out. Did it with the team that filmed and edits all of Anthony Bourdain's stuff. Super cinematic, super gritty. And I don't know what doors that's going to open or not. So if I had a reliable 5-year plan, if you think about it, if I had a 5-year plan I thought I could realistically achieve, I would have to aim so far below my maximum potential, kind of my red line point, that I'd be selling myself short. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So I do these short-term experiments, and I have no idea what door will open. So if I end up talking to an amazing director and screenwriter and they say, we want to take your first book and adapt it and turn it into a feature film, I could absolutely see myself doing that. On the other hand, if someone approaches me and they say, you know, we think your skill, we saw your TV show, and we want you to work with Rangers and Navy SEALs on language acquisition, I could see spending time on that. And I don't chase... This is another thing that might be helpful for people. I don't chase what makes me happy because happiness is a very fleeting emotional state that can be bought with a bottle of wine or other things. It's very nebulous. It's a term that's overused a lot. And so I seek out and chase the things that excite me. And if you chase the things that excite you, excitement is, for me, kind of the cure-all. It takes care of so many other things. It's the lead domino, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's the one thing that if you knock it over, it basically takes care of just about everything else.
You know, I do think the 5-year goals are so 20th century. And with today's hyperflexing dynamic world and what's possible, we don't even know what 5 years looks like from today. But the answer to this question has become common. I remember when I interviewed Pete Cashmore of Mashable, I asked him what his goals were. And he said, you know, all I'm trying to do is get better today than I was yesterday and set myself up today to be better tomorrow than I am today. And you know, it's been a common answer to a lot of the hyperachievers is if I had set a goal to be where I'm at right now, I certainly would have underperformed my current position. So the one thing that is seemingly encouraged, though, by those that are achievement-minded is to have, you know, 12-week goals. Like, you have an annual goal, you got a direction you're pointing your life towards, and then really focusing on, like, what's happening the next 12 weeks, because that's the span of time that you can really head down and get focused on, choose your priorities, stay clear and clean with, and it's a time horizon that's realistic that the world will be somewhat similar 12 weeks down the line.
No, definitely. And I'll give one more piece of advice also for people who feel overwhelmed, perhaps with choices, options, distractions. And that is a commencement speech by Neil Gaiman, who's an incredible writer, one of my favorites, Neil Gaiman, G-A-I-M-A-N. And it's called Make Good Art. And the Make Good Art speech is right up there with the Stanford commencement address by Steve Jobs. Those are two of my favorite videos to watch and rewatch. So those, I think, can also help really give folks the ability to take a 30,000-foot view at what they're doing, as opposed to just being stuck in the weeds in a reactive mode, which is very easy to do. And we all end up there sometimes.
Before I ask my last question, this is more of a selfish question, but I think it's important for all great leaders, because I think the way you get to great answers is to ask great questions. And like you, I'm in the interview business. And so you've been developing and refining your interviewing skills. What is the question that draws the most out of a guest personality or character that you have seen to be most poignant?
Well, that itself is a good question. I would have to do a quick run through. Let me think about this, because I've done 60 or 70 podcasts now with all sorts of characters, from, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger to the tech icons and the billionaires like Peter Thiel, who's the first money into Facebook. What question pulls interesting things out? The one that comes to mind, and maybe it's because I just mentioned Peter Thiel, because it's a variant on a question that he asks people before he hires them or invests in their companies. But I think it's, and this is a variation on how he phrases it, but what is something you believe that other people think is crazy? I think that's an extremely powerful question. And most top performers I've bumped into, on some level, have a handful of beliefs that most of the world, not necessarily all, but most of the world thinks is entirely insane. And that I find to be a useful question.
So I can't resist to turn the question back on you then, for our listeners to pull out of the head of Tim Ferriss. What is a belief that you have that other people would think is crazy?
There are many. Let's see. I believe this. One amazing blog post, or one amazing video, one amazing audio interview can completely change your life. And I say that from experience, because I had the experience of putting a lot of time into one blog post called From Geek to Freak, how I gained, I think it's 34 pounds of muscle in 1 month. Putting a ton of time into that, and it was my first piece to ever hit the homepage of, at the time, it was dig.com, D-I-G-D.com. And that really created the landslide in a way that led to the success in the early days of the 4-Hour Workweek. So the point being, don't focus on putting out 10 blog posts a week, 5 blog posts a day. The volume game is a race to the bottom. Focus on putting out incredibly good stuff. And if you just get one of those right, it could change your life.
So wrapping up here, last question for you today, Tim. Since we've been talking a lot about learning and accelerating learning, I think the perfect question to wrap up our discussion here on is, tell us the one thing you hope that we learned from you and your experiences through this interview. What do you hope people take away from their time and maybe even reading further about your story in the pages of Success Magazine as well?
What I hope people take away is, let's make it a short list. Number one, you're the average of the 5 people you associate with most. Financially, emotionally, physically, you have to choose those people very carefully. And then secondly, whenever people will tell you you should do something, or you believe in your head you should do something, you can't do something, ask yourself, you know, what are my self-imposed limitations and what can I challenge? What have I given up on is perhaps the best way to start. What are dreams I've given up on? Whether it's going to Greece, learning a language, playing the guitar, getting good at basketball, tennis, what are the things I've given up on or just put on the shelf that have gathered a lot of dust? And pick one of those off the shelf and find one that you will enjoy even if you don't become world class. That's key number one, because it improves the chances of you becoming world class also. And then commit to really digging in and making that one of your highest priorities for the next 8 to 12 weeks. And I would encourage you also to build in some accountability, some type of, you know, reward or punishment that encourages you to keep your promises to yourself. And you can use sites like coach.me, which allows you to find sort of accountability partners. Coach.me is a very good tool. Also, dietbet.com if you want to put some money on the line to lose some weight. And you can create a betting pool online with that, or stick.com, S-D-I-C-K-K.com, which can also help. And I think if people just took away that and implemented one or both of those, that, you know, 6 months from now, they and their lives could be fundamentally different and better.
That's fantastic. Well, Mr. Tim Ferriss, thank you for coming in and helping our listeners improve the design of their lifestyle. And thank you so much for coming in and being with us here at Success.
My pleasure, always.